An interesting character, loved golf. He and I were playing golf one time, and he actually had won a skin or two, and he would not let me leave the course until I paid him that $3. So you know that about Alan, don't you?
Absolutely.
Next to Marty is another person who has been with us in the past, Shane Carr, who is the Vice President for Government Affairs at the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers. Prior to joining the Alliance, Shane had worked as a Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Transportation, and the reason I had the Nebraska Congressman on my mind is because it was Shane who worked for Nebraska Congressman Doug Beirider. Mm-hmm. So he has some familiarity with agriculture and a lot of the issues that we deal with all the time. And Shane has always been a really straight shooter, a true professional, and I consider him a friend. A newcomer to this panel, who I think was a little bit nervous coming into the lion's den.
He's been in the tables the whole time he's been here. He's not nervous in the least.
Well, that makes sense. But Louis Frenkel is the Executive Vice President, Government Affairs for, hold your breath, the Grocer Manufacturers Association. He's also worked for oil companies like Exxon, a number of lobbying groups with government affairs offices working on energy issues. I got to know Louis quite well when he was chief of staff to the chairman of the Science and Technology Committee, Bart Gordon, who was a strong supporter of the renewable fuel standard. And it was great working with Louis to try to make sure we could implement this program successfully, and he was always wonderful to work with and saw the benefit of the renewable fuel standard and worked awfully hard for the chairman to get that bill passed. So, Louis, welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
You saw that Rob Berhoot made it off the stage successfully. You will as well.
I'm not all that worried.
I thought for this insiders panel this year that it might make sense to bring in the insider of all insiders, and that's Jim Massey. Jim is a founder of a company called the Alpine Group. It's a company that specializes in energy issues, tax issues, environmental issues, agriculture. Jim, at one point or other throughout his career, has represented all of us on this panel, or worked with all
of
us, and that makes him a very unique person, I think, being able to represent effectively and without bias, each of us at times, is a real skill. So I appreciate Jim joining us on this panel. I will note that Jim, as the insider of insiders, has never, ever in his career been quoted. So, my admonition to the media in the room is that pearls of wisdom from Jim should probably be considered off the record unless you get permission from Jim.
That would be helpful. That would be
Bob,
helpful.
Did he pay you for that?
No, I just want him to continue working for me, that's all. All right, let's begin. We're going to have some fun today. We are actually all friends, and I like to conduct this panel as if we're all sitting at the Monocle having a beer, in Jim's case, a glass of wine, a Pinot. Yeah. But
you're having a Merlot.
But
Louis is having a Maker's brandy.
See, so, you know. Jim's proving my point. The insider of insider, he knows what we all drink. Louis.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
Thank you.
We just had the Super Bowl. What were you rooting for the Super Bowl?
I wasn't. I watched, but I didn't care either way.
You didn't?
I just wanted a good game.
Did you have some chicken wings?
I bet the over.
Bet the over. But did you have chicken wings at your Super Bowl party?
Chili? No chicken wings.
I had chicken wings. They were great. And you know what? There was no shortage whatsoever of chicken wings.
But you paid a higher price, didn't you?
No, actually, I didn't. Well, maybe I did because it was here. But typically not. All right. Do you have your number two pencil out?
Sure.
What's food price inflation today?
Oh, I guess it's about 4% annually.
Oh, you got that one wrong. 1.8%. Just came out last week. What was food price inflation in 2010?
I don't remember.
0.8%, the lowest in 46 years. Do you know what the food price inflation has been since 2005 when the RFS was passed?
Well, I think you got to gauge it off of 2007, but it's probably an aggregate of about 1.2.
Whether you do it from 2005 or 2007, sure. It's still it's about 2%, which is in line with where it has been for a decade or more.
Sure.
Do you know what it was prior to the RFS, let's just say from 1980 to 2004?
Higher.
Much higher. So here's my question for you.
Yeah.
How can you say with any credibility that the RFS is driving food price inflation when the food price inflation rates have been lower than before the RFS was passed? Well, I'm having trouble with this one.
I think there's a couple of different factors. First of which is there's been significant consolidation in my industry over the course of time, which has created additional efficiency. There's a whole lot of technological improvement in my industry, which has allowed them to make the same products for a lower cost. It doesn't mean the input costs aren't higher. It doesn't mean that consumers aren't paying a higher price. The second part of it is, you know, as you measure against and you review the input costs and you review consumer spending and you look at the economic downturn, the fact of the matter is people are buying less product of everything. We all know that, right? It's hard as a branded company to start all of a sudden increasing your costs without a consumer backlash. So as if you look in that same period during the food inflation, my companies are having a harder time, their margins are getting tighter and tighter, and there's no place for them to go, and they're in a very competitive marketplace with each other on a global scale for both commodity and input and for consumer behavior.
Okay. So your costs are going up, and the profits of your companies like Smithfield
and your costs are going up.
Yeah, our costs are going up too.
I think that we would all agree. I think that the one thing that we would probably all agree on as manufacturers of food and manufacturers of fuel is that $7.34 isn't a good price for an input. And if the price of oil was lower, you would be feeling more pain on it.
Well, I think what we could all agree on is that the skyrocketing price of oil is also having an impact on all of our costs. Most specifically, the costs of food manufacturers. And when you say, as you do, that corn prices have increased, and they have.
And
they've increased, I'll get the number wrong, Jeff will correct me later, but it's about 20%.
53%.
I'll take your number, fine, because I'm still going to be able to make this point. Oil prices have increased 80%. And so...
Since when?
Huh? Since 2005. When? So...
Just to pick a year arbitrarily.
It's not an arbitrary number. It's when the RFS was
just
began.
Think how much higher that oil price would be if we didn't have such a revolution in oil production right here in the United States. 40% increase in oil production since 2008. Just the increase alone is more than Nigeria produces in it.
And how much higher the oil price would be if we didn't have biofuels adding to that supply.
You know what? Absolutely.
Biofuels
is a piece of the equation. But for you to take credit for the entire...
I didn't take credit for it all.
Decrease in imports.
I didn't take credit for
it all. Your chart earlier is a little hard to believe.
I didn't take credit for it.
Go ahead. This is your panel.
No, this is...
You go right ahead.
Interrupt, because this is what we'd be doing at the Monaco. We're already, you know, throwing things at each other.
There's nobody out there, so don't worry.
My point is, Lewis, before I get to Marty, with oil prices skyrocketing, particularly in a couple of those years, 2008, for example, why is it that your member companies, your trade association, want to say it's all about ethanol, it's all about biofuels, and not recognizing...
We never...
Because I haven't seen a campaign about...
We never say...
About oil prices.
We never say it's all about ethanol. We never say that. We never say that... the economic impacts on my member companies, on their employees, on consumers is all about ethanol. We never say that. We say it's a significant part of it. But we talk about ethanol as one of the significant drivers on a very significant input cost. And it doesn't just drive input costs on raw material, just the corn for us. I mean, we all know that corn is not just an ingredient in the products I make, my companies make, but It's the base for sweeteners. It's the base for a lot of feed for livestock. All of that aggregate is what drives it up. And I don't think there's any question, in addition to the price of corn being much higher, that the price of livestock is much higher. Now, again, I don't attribute that exclusively to the RFS, but it's a significant contributor. And that's not me saying it. That's the Congressional Research Service. That's Wall Street analysts. I mean, it's not just me.
All right, let's try to agree on this one a little bit. Can you just humor me for a moment?
Sure.
Will you say publicly, for all here, that oil prices also have a significant impact on the price of food?
I don't think it has a significant impact. I think it has an impact on our cost of transporting our food.
You're a good advocate for your industry.
but that raises a question. So if we want to take the pie on what your costs are, so how much is your energy cost versus your advertising cost versus your raw material cost? Because I think that's what you want to talk
about. Sure. I mean, in the end, I mean, this is far outside the scope of what you all want to talk about.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is that natural gas prices are also incredibly low. So it balances out our overall energy impacts. With natural gas prices being low and oil price being high, there's a place in the middle where it kind of cuts into it. And we pay, our annualized costs are far more for natural gas for running our facilities.
Right.
And for our electricity to run our facilities than it is for our transport.
How much of the cost and what percent is in advertising?
Yeah, I think that's different for every company. But advertising costs are also a significant factor.
Right.
And packaging. And I mean, there's a whole
distribution and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for being here.
Bob, I'm happy to be here.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, let's take a step back for a moment from the battles that we have and maybe take a look at this from 30,000 feet. What is your definition of energy security?
Definition of energy security?
Yeah.
That means as a nation, we're going to have more control over our destiny, our energy future. That means we can produce more of it here, create more jobs, produce more energy, generate more revenue for the government. I mean, the fact that we now have this ability to create so much more energy here in the U.S., that's what's bringing manufacturers back to the United States. We're seeing a renaissance and a revolution in manufacturing throughout the Rust Belt, all across the country. That's what's going to provide us greater energy security. It's allowing us to have a greater influence on the global market on energy. The reason that the sanctions on Iran right now are being as effective as they are, yes, Saudi Arabia was able to push up its production, but also because of the huge increase in production here in the U.S. So all of those things together, it's energy security, job security, national security, and putting us in a position to play a much bigger role on the global stage.
Is energy diversity at all a part of that equation for you, or is it just about petroleum?
No. Us being able to, we're in all of the above. Absolutely. And that's why I think you always put this in terms of a battle. When we talk about the battles. Even this, this is a battle for the barrel.
It's
nice when you're in Las Vegas. Maybe there's a big fight somewhere here. What you skip over is that even when, John was talking earlier about how consensus around APIs said, time for us to go ahead and call for repeal of the RFS. What every company around that table also said is make clear every time we talk about it, as we do, we're not against renewable fuels. We're not against the RFA. We're not against ethanol. We think this program doesn't work. We've been trying for 7 years to get to make it work. At this point, time to start over.
When John was up here earlier, he did seem like an enlightened oil guy. He was pretty reasonable, saying, let's maybe address some of the blend wall issues. He can, certainly expressed his company's position that they are still in support, not just of renewables, mm-hmm. but of the renewable fuel standard. And that's kind of where API was a while ago as well. What changed at API? You don't have to necessarily give me the way the company's lined up. Yeah. I can probably guess. But what was the trigger that somehow at some point this fall, API woke up and said, we're not going to try to seek changes to this thing. We want to repeal it altogether.
Well, we are seeking changes, and we have been seeking changes since for years. And our member companies, not just Shell, all of them around the table, have been very constructive in putting together ideas for how do we make this work. We haven't had any success there. We had success last week when the court finally realized that at least the cellulosic piece didn't make any sense. But even setting that aside, it's like, You know, now we've got, this isn't about API getting in front of the, you know, leading the charge. Hell, we're joining the chorus of all the different people that have spoken up and said, we're not saying we're against renewable fuels, but this program's not working. And, you know, our feeling is that, in, quite frankly, Bob, you didn't vilify me any less last year than you did this year in your opening remarks this morning. So we don't gain anything by being reasonable.
I'm really intended to.
So what do I gain by being reasonable? Instead, I'm going to try to make sure that we can find a way to make the program work. And we'll work with anybody that wants to be part of that. But sometimes I think, and you're not asking me for my advice on how RFA should position itself, but you've kind of put things together as us against the world. Anybody that says anything bad against the RFS, well, that's heresy. Let's go after them. And I think that may not work out for you at the end.
Well, it's made more difficult when API, which does change the political equation here, because I've always viewed the API as the good cop to NPRA's bad cop, but when you come out and say, no, we just want to repeal it. But there was discussion this morning on the panel about the flexibility inherent in the RFS. Mm-hmm. And I had made the comment that there is nothing wrong with the RFS that can't be fixed with what is right with the RFS, and that is a comment on, indeed, its inherent flexibility. It's not just...
Are you asserting that it is inherently flexible?
Absolutely.
Okay. Help me understand what that means.
Well, when EPA will waive 98% of the cellulosic requirement, when
because
you've got
no
the credit
production
level
no production.
Is zero, any number above zero doesn't make any sense.
Well, look.
We're not against cellulosic fuels. Absolutely. When they're produced, as even John said, we're gonna continue to use ethanol, whether there's a mandate or not. It's got great properties. We use it for a lot of good reasons. But let's have a program that actually makes sense on how to do that.
Yeah, but Marty, are you talking about the pre-2005 volumes of ethanol, or are you talking about something in the 2007, 8, 9, 10 volumes of ethanol? Because how many plants are we going to put out of business and how many workers are we going to put out of business when we take out the RFS?
Well, but I think going forward, we do have to be realistic about how much is being produced, the fact that we do have a smaller pool that we're working with.
Right.
Clearly, we're driving less. You know, the pool's going down, the mandate keeps going up. At some point, there's got to be a reckoning here to say, does this all still make sense?
Right.
And while we've been trying to, you know, work and work for the agency...
It's hard to say that the oil industry, and they're good friends of mine, but it's hard to say the oil industry has been very helpful at how you get over the blend wall past, you know, basically 13.5 billion gallons, other than to say it won't work and you're not going to help.
Well, while we're on this topic, and I think, as Bob noted earlier, in a previous life, I ran the House Science and Technology Committee for Chairman Gordon. And in addition to that, was one of the primary House negotiators in 2007. So the creation of the cellulosic mandate, the advanced biofuels mandate, the underpinning research programs that went along with it, the RFS was constructed, especially in 2007, as a full package. It wasn't just a mandate for ethanol from corn feedstock.
Absolutely.
It was developed as a comprehensive package with corn being the precursor.
Yeah, the driver.
And the starting point with a success with successor fuels coming forward and the promise of that technology developing. I think now we've faced a problem where that technology has not come forward. And the safety mechanism by which we created in 2005 and then ultimately in 2007, which we tried to refine, was the EPA waiver, was the safety net, was that if we have extraordinary circumstances, then we can utilize that, right? So last year, we all know that the corn crop was significantly less than it was supposed to be, than it was expected to be. It was all because of an extraordinary drought, the 100-year drought, and we didn't have a lot of snow this year. So we could be in the same exact place next year with extraordinarily high corn prices, a more limited corn crop, record exports of ethanol, again, which, again, is great. You're, you know, producing almost 15 billion gallons with a mandated level in the 13s. But corn prices are still running up. So where is the flexibility mechanism that you support, that you would work with us on, that would help relieve that kind of problem?
Well, corn prices are coming down some now, but
the important part to this and this is what I think EPA's decision was based on, is you can't look at a corn price in a one-year,
sure,
basically, time. We've had $1.75 corn. We've had 3.25 corn. So the answer is that what I think EPA chose is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater in its analysis of the waiver request last year. If this continues to be a problem of yield and drought, I think you'll see a different EPA decision and analysis.
But the waiver authority is a year-by-year waiver?
But the other thing to remember is just the same time that you want to talk about this being a bad year of corn supply, remember, our yields did fabulous for a drought.
Sure.
And that, remember, we've had basically a doubling of corn capacity the last 40 years. And we're expecting a doubling of capacity of corn production in the next 20 years.
But that's doubled because demand exists, not just because of the
harvest. Why does demand exist? Go back to Jimmy Carter, and when he killed demand for any exports of U.S. corn in 1980, and the problems he left our farmers in.
Sure.
So,
and I'm not arguing.
We're all affected by government programs. Mm-hmm. And some of them have been more helpful and some of them have been, sure, less helpful. Mm. When Carter decided to use, you know, food against guns, it really did have an adverse impact. It basically what created the corn and the major, you know, crops in South,
sure,
America. And as a result, we've lost tremendous market share.
Well, I would argue that taking the human element and the arbitrary nature of the waiver authority out of the equation and creating more realistic thresholds by which to evaluate is a more reasonable way to do it, both for business planning for all parties.
That's an excellent point.
And if we were all smart enough to find out what that secret magic formula was, maybe you'd be right. But I would not assume, as you do, that just because a waiver was not granted last year, that it doesn't work. In fact, we sort of think there was a partial waiver. The marketplace created it, not EPA, because 36 of our plants have shut down. They do respond to the signals.
Well, and is that
the flexibility?
Because
what EPA was looking at. What EPA was looking at is the fact that there were still 2.5 billion credits that were available to marketers, sure, to meet the demand. Again, we're talking about the flexibility of the RFS, and that there wasn't going to be an issue for refiners to meet their obligation, which ultimately is it about. Now, if this year the same situation occurs, I think Jim is right, the insider's insider, that you might have a different conclusion. But ultimately, EPA's responsibility is to look at oil companies' ability to meet their obligation, and clearly they could.
Well, that's not what the waiver authority says. The waiver authority says economic harm. That's what it says in a state or a group of states.
And there wasn't found to be any economic harm.
No, I think there was economic harm.
Well, I know you think that there was, but all of the data that EPA had in front of it suggested otherwise.
I think your farmers would argue that they had economic harm, the ones that couldn't sell, that didn't have product to sell.
Well, I feel bad, Shane, for Shane sitting here watching a tennis match.
I'm a strong believer in the Hippocratic Oath, right? First, do no harm, and as long as I'm not talking, I probably can't do anything.
Let me ask you this, because while you probably aren't really terribly excited about jumping into the RFS debate and the interest on warfare, it might impact you as well. Let me ask you first what some of your legislative objectives are this year, and then I'll loop back into the RFS point.
My legislative objectives are probably not of really significant interest to this crowd, though based on the discussion this morning, we are very interested in, it's not necessarily legislative, but where discussions go on US-EU trade agreements and harmonization of manufacturing standards and tax reform as well, though I think our interests are in kind of a different place. But, you know, on the energy side, we are obviously watching the debate about the RFS pick up. We have not picked a side, per se, as you have noted. But I think in 2007, when ESA was being written, we were very focused on the fuel economy section of that law. Hits us very directly. And we were less focused on RFS2. And I do think that going forward, should there be any serious effort to revisit the RFS, notwithstanding your button, We are going to be very engaged this go-round because we have sort of, as the downstream kind of implementers, seen some of the challenges that have arisen when we kind of weren't at the table in 07. So.
Well, here's the RFS hook.
Yep.
If Marty's successful and you have a repeal the RFS bill on the committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, and there's a markup going on, and they've just now opened up the Clean Air Act. Are you concerned about other amendments that might show up? Because now you've got the Clean Air Act open for amendment. And then, Jim, I'll ask you if you should be concerned.
He's got one.
Well, I did not say that.
Marty, by the way, before you answer, I want to make sure we're clear that Bob holds you personally responsible for repeal of the RFS.
and that'll be arranged.
And therefore, you're going to take Jack for it.
At a later point in time.
Right. Not completely. Right. I'll give Charlie Drevna a little bit of credit.
That doesn't hurt me back home. That's all right.
Exactly. Well, you know, in past, having being a veteran of this panel, in past years, you always ask us to make predictions about things. And so if I had to make a prediction about, you know, whether the RFS is repealed in the 113th Congress, I would say it's extremely unlikely. But again, I do expect the debate to pick up and there to be a lot of discussion, less about repeal and maybe more about reform. I'm not sure that that has much of a prospect of actually getting over a goal line either. Where I sit right now, I don't see the 60 votes to repeal the RFS.
Marty, what about you? I mean, it's not necessarily all upside. If the Clean Air Act is open and you've got Henry Waxman sitting there thinking about, hey, there are opportunities here. Are you concerned about facing amendments that might be hostile to your interests?
Well, I think this is obviously a significant enough issue for our member companies that, you know, they want to make sure we move forward on this debate. I mean, to Shane's point, I'm not going to predict that this Congress will get anything done or over the finish line, and I don't mean that to be too negative on the Congress, but I just think, you know, making predictions about what's going to happen until we get through the budget issues, it's kind of a fool's errand right now. But I do think that there's no question. There's a lot more dialogue about this issue, about energy generally, and about this issue specifically. And I think it is very positive for, you know, for my members to make sure this discussion happens, to move this ahead. And, you know, Jim, to your point, if there are things that we're standing in the way of, well, let's put those on the table as well. But it also feels like any time there's been a suggestion for how we might be able to change something or the flexibility, it's, you know, there goes big oil again, and now we got angry birds and hungry hogs and all the rest. I mean, the name calling might be fun, but, you know, I think there's a legitimate question and a legitimate dialogue that has to take place, and we're more than willing and prepared to do that.
You know, it's worth acknowledging in the context of this, in the context of the conversation about the Clean Air Act, that I think we would all agree, being Washington practitioners, that if there was to be some, if there was going to be a bill that was addressing the RFS, forget about what gets introduced, mm-hmm. that something that was to advance would likely be part of a more comprehensive package as it was in 2005 and 2007, which, if that was the case, would likely open the Clean Air Act in some way, shape, or form anyway, especially with the appetites of the House to look at the administration's rulemakings on a whole array of other emissions issues on mobile source, on stationary source, on power plants. So,
exactly.
I mean, I think that...
plenty of opportunities. Yeah, right.
So, Jim, give them some indication of what some of those amendments might be. Not that they right. don't
done
expect
a great
them,
job
but...
identifying, mm-hmm. it, you know, the fuel setback in the back of the Energy and Commerce or in the back of the Environment and Public Works Committees, the answer is there are lots of people that are worried and nervous about what EPA is doing about coal-fired power plants, as Lewis said, about refiners and the requirements that refiners are going to have, about the Tier 3 standards, mm-hmm. and a whole host of things that we haven't even thought about that EPA is about to roll down the rulemaking process that are going to cause us, as well as many of Congress's members, to be worried about. Mm-hmm. This is not just an oil industry or a RFS in an ethanol industry or an auto concern. Everybody's looking at what EPA is trying to do right this moment. And quite frankly,
I'm not. I don't care.
You don't care.
We'll find one
way to make you care.
I care about commercial rules associated with air emissions off of slaughterhouses. Then, so you know,
that's AMI's problem.
And that dynamic may force a good discussion on how to actually fix the problem.
I think that's what happens when you open up the Clean Air Act. There's a lot more problems. The RFS is an issue, and it's got a lot of weight and attention. But I think there's a lot of other problems that are sort of piling up in the back corner as well.
Let's switch gears just a little bit, because I think every one of us will acknowledge that as lobbyists in Washington, these days far more of what we do has to do with regulations than legislation. Shane, EPA sent to the White House last week its tier-through rulemaking that's going to require MARTI to greatly reduce sulfur. What do you see?
Hopefully.
What do you expect is going to happen? And then I want MARTI to react to that.
What EPA says is going to happen is that a notice of proposed rulemaking is going to be on the street next month, with the goal of issuing a final rule by the end of calendar year 2013. There clearly will be a very significant vehicle component there. It's largely going to marry up with regulations that we're already following in California and roughly 40% of the vehicle market. So in that sense, as long as the national regulations are harmonized with the 40% that's already out there, that we're in a good place. The other component is the fuels component. Our understanding is that EPA is considering very seriously reducing the sulfur content in fuel. I don't think they're going to touch any of the other controversial fuel issues.
Marty, how are you guys feeling about the Tier 3 rule as we all understand it to be right now?
Well, we've got serious concerns about the Tier 3 proposal as it's out there now. And it's another one of these where we want to be sure, and we'll be optimistic till we aren't. The science has got to lead this discussion. We've got the data to show that the relative improvement between Tier 2 as it is now and what's going to be accomplished by moving to the Tier 3 on the sulfur levels, and the cost that's going to be associated with that just makes no sense. So again, that process is just getting started here this year with the rule having gone over, and we'll be fully engaged in that. But we've got serious concerns about what that's going to mean to increasing the price of fuel.
Shane,
to say nothing of the cost to the refiners themselves.
What do you think about API studies saying that there's not much benefit there to reducing sulfur?
Well, actually, I'm not really able to opopine on the health benefit kind of cost issues. We're interested in that fuel, in a 10 ppm fuel, sulfur fuel, primarily because it will be easier for us to use lean burn technologies and meet fuel efficiency standards. So, that's our interest, and that we clearly believe would be the case. I don't really have an opinion on whether the cost-benefit susses out.
Jim, last week, several members of Congress, I've got the number, but wrote a letter saying stop the Tier 3 implementation. What is your expectation on Capitol Hill and the interaction with the regulatory process here?
At least at this point in time, and I bet we all would agree, the administration is going to move forward with this proposal, and they care very little about what Capitol Hill thinks at this moment in time on this.
Yeah.
maybe it's unfair to me to say, but I think after the last two very frustrating years by President Obama, I think he's decided that he will engage Congress as little as possible, and he will build his legacy through the administration and through regulatory action. So You know, no matter how many rocks Capitol Hill throws at him, I think his answer is he's going to proceed until Congress can move a bill and change his mind, and I think he doesn't think that's going to happen very often.
Lewis, I have to believe that not every waking hour of yours is spent on the RFS.
No.
help me out here. Is it 5%?
Well, and 10%? To be honest, I would say that, you know, in the kind of year I've been at GMA, I've spent far less time on this than I have on a host of other things.
What are some of those other things?
Food content, sodium levels in food content, nutrition facts panel, front of pack labeling, obesity efforts, ensuring the continued viability of genetically engineered ingredients.
Labeling, GMO, those type of things?
Yep.
Do you see opportunities to try to work with agriculture on some of those issues?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think we do already. You know, just as a matter of background, we had a mandatory labeling proposal in California that was a ballot measure that would have mandated all food containing genetically engineered ingredients would have to be labeled as such. We put together a coalition of 160 state and national organizations in California, including the bulk of which was the agriculture community, to combat this, which would have had significant, we've already had a lot of conversation about food inflation and costs. The proposal in California would cost the average family $400 per year every year going forward for the same products they buy today. So we are inherently engaged with our value chain, and will continue to be going forward.
Because I think just as a matter of priorities, it seems to me that's something that you ought to be working with a heck of a lot more than this RFS thing. You ought to just put that in the back part.
Bob, I will offer you this. I think that with all these other kind of production agricultural issues that my industry engages with our value chain on, from one end, from farm all the way to fork, I think, and I'm hopeful, that there will be a lot of goodwill developed in that discussion on other issues, and hopefully that goodwill can translate over to a healthy dialogue about ways we can talk about reforming the RFS and look for ways where we can reach agreement to add more flexibility that provides you with business certainty and us with business certainty.
Again, I think there's plenty of flexibility there, but we'll continue to agree to disagree. Jim?
Me too. I'm sorry.
We're not agreeing to disagree. We're just agreeing that you're wrong.
Consistency is a virtue unless you're consistently wrong.
I'm not agreeing that Marty's wrong.
Well, I think he said one thing that's very important to us, and that we want business certainty. And that's the issue around the advanced biofuels numbers that need
Absolutely.
To be continued by EPA. Because without EPA at least pushing that number out, then there is no business certainty for those advanced cellulose ethanol numbers, which you helped all of us put together and develop back in 2007. I'm sorry, you were asked a question.
No, that's good. Actually, you reminded me, I didn't get back to Marty on one small point I did want to clarify. You had made note of the fact that the courts last week had thrown out a part of the cellulosic mandate. They didn't really throw it out. They remanded it back to EPA
told them they couldn't add.
But essentially told them, stop putting your federal finger on the scales for cellulose, call them as you see them. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be enough to satisfy API? You're going to continue to pursue this litigation track you're on this? Or?
Well, enough to satisfy. I mean, they turned around the next week and went ahead and required even greater greater amounts of cellulosic ethanol when we still are at zero as far as what's commercially available. So, no, we continue to have a concern with the way EPA is implementing the program.
But when EPA is looking at not just data, but actual steel in the ground, INEOS, their plant is complete. They are going through the process to bring it up into production if they're not in production already today. Mm-hmm. And Keyur clearly has an advanced biofuel that is in production or will be soon. And I think they were actually somewhat conservative in ignoring some of the other cellulosic opportunities. If you get cellulose being produced at existing grain ethanol facilities from the fiber coming into those facilities, that wasn't counted. They didn't count the production that could likely be coming from other cellulose facilities that are under construction and will be completed before the end of this year.
So 15 billion gallons by 2022, no problem.
I think EPA is very satisfied that they'll be able to make that.
I tell you what, we'll remain very optimistic that all that comes to pass. But until they can actually show us that there's something being produced, I think it just is kind of silly to then say, you know, we're at zero. We've reduced the mandate from up here down to something more than zero. It's like, well, wait a minute. There's still nothing there. So I hope all of those come through.
But it is.
But
there.
I think
that's
there's
got to
be. But no, it isn't. I mean, it's not available now. I hope it will be. What do we have?
20 million gallons of current production capacity? Is that about right?
What's that?
There was a piece in the Washington Post last week.
Right, about the total capacity.
It was 20 million.
20 million, something like that, yeah.
On the two plants.
Brooke Coleman can give you, and I would encourage Brooke to do so, give you his booklet on just where the 14 cellulosic ethanol projects are. And they're.
Look,
not against cellulosic, not against any of it, but let's make sure it's actually.
You're making a good point about where we've been, but I think you also have to look at where we're going in 2013.
And that's
why I think there is a little bit of a difference between the industries. And we believe we're actually going to have gallons out there for the marketplace this year.
Let me kind of completely switch gears here. Shane, in certain parts of the country today, suboctane fuel is being sold. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in South Dakota last year, the State Petroleum Association wanted to mandate a suboctane fuel.
Yes, and we testified against it in the state legislature.
Because right. The auto manufacturers will not warranty suboctane fuels. What has confused me somewhat, though, Shane, is that there's overblown concern about, in my view, E15 being
Thank
out there.
Thank you for adding in your view.
I think that's perfectly
You've really
obvious.
Come a long way
People
since
know
8
I've got views, right? but I haven't seen the level of attention or certainly the level of outrage about suboctane fuels coming from the automakers. And it seems to me that's a far bigger issue in terms of the amount of fuel that's out there.
I just told you that we were all over South Dakota. Clearly suboctane fuels is a very significant issue to us. We were one of the key opponents of the move in South Dakota and would continue to oppose similar efforts around the country.
That was a bill to require it. Yep. The fact is that there is suboctane fuel still being sold commercially. And, the Alliance and the auto manufacturers aren't out there with a campaign to call attention to it, to warn consumers that they're violating their warranties and to put a stop to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, might you at some point?
That's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that question.
All we're looking
you're going
for
out,
is some,
you're going sort of outside my depth.
Some perspective and some balance here, because some of the concerns that have been expressed about E15 we think are a little bit overstated, given the very real concerns that you expressed in South Dakota in opposing that mandate with respect to suboctane. We're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes. So you had mentioned that in previous panels, we always try to get some predictions out of this panel.
That was Shane.
These insiders. Oh, I'm sorry, Shane. You're right. But you folks are some professional prognosticators when it comes to political people. Marty, who do you think is going to be the next administrator of EPA?
Right now, I'd say that they're probably going to go more internal. So whether it's Bob Perciasepe or
Gina McCarthy.
Gina, thank you. Gina McCarthy. That's my guess now. But they still got a whole long list of other folks they've been looking at. And as we saw, I don't know if anyone saw today, they did nominate Sally Jewell to Interior, so which was kind of a surprise in that I hadn't seen.
It's not a name on any list.
And somebody knows a lot about the oil and gas industry and public lands, royalties and stuff. She'll be very helpful.
She was an engineer.
She'll
Mobil.
Be very helpful.
She worked for Mobil for earlier in her career. But anyway, I think this is the interesting parlor game right now. Who's going to be filling the seats going forward? But I still think that one's going to be more internal.
So Gina or Bob?
Yeah.
API will enthusiastically support either, I presume?
I think both of them have been very constructive in working with us. We're obviously not always on the same page, but I think Gina both of them, Gina and Bob, have been very constructive in reaching out to us and having a dialogue. Again, don't always agree, but that works.
Shane, next Secretary of Energy.
I guess sort of the home state partisan, I should say Jennifer Granholm. I don't know, to be honest with you. I haven't been super focused on energy. I mean, I've seen the names. I've been more interested in EPA and transportation. But certainly Granholm's name has been kicked around quite a bit for energy. And Interior is now filled up, which was another one that she was supposedly interested in. So maybe it'll be Governor Granholm.
Well, certainly seeing her speech at the convention, she's got plenty of energy.
Yeah.
And she participated in a big event that DOE did around inauguration, if not
Governor Granholm or another governor, I think that it's probably fair to believe that the president would go back to academia again in the same way he did with Secretary.
That was a successful move.
I'm not arguing with that. Another.
Lewis, assuming that you don't follow the energy
and
EPA issues that closely, I'm going to ask you a broader one. Sure. Does Hillary run or not run?
Wow. I don't think she does. I don't think she does.
We might have to agree on that one, too. See, there is agreement.
There we go.
Better yet, do you think the vice president's going to run?
Yes.
I think he's already running. Jim, as the insiders, which of these predictions are right?
Oh, let's see. First off, let's go to Shane's on DOT, on DOE. Governor Granholm's name has not been atop the list, but I agree with Shane. She deserves a spot in this cabinet. We hear that almost all the rest of these new vacancies in the cabinet will be announced in the next couple days, so that the president will have something to point to at the State of the Union next Tuesday. Expect quite a few more women to come out of this, and that's why I think Governor Granholm's got a spot, whether it's at DOE or someplace else. Marty, you speculated on EPA. I guess my view of EPA is that if the president is doing what he says he is, tacking over on climate, I think Gina will be the nominee at this point. We've worked well with both, but if he's going to do what he says he's going to do, I think that's where he goes.
The woman issue, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, Lewis, I have a bumper sticker in my office that says, "I'm in to win." It's a Hillary Clinton last time around sticker. I haven't put it away yet, but I completely agree with you. I think she's going to hang out the Spurs and go make money and relax.
I think she's going to have a life.
Yeah. And having been with Vice President Biden about 2 weeks ago, I can tell you he's
running.
All right. This has been enjoyable for me anyway. I hope it's been informative and somewhat entertaining for you. But the message, I think, from this panel, because both Shane and Marty seem to agree, that they didn't think that legislation repealing the RFS was going to happen this year. So if Rachel is writing a story, I think that would be the story from the discussion.
But careful, join Bob, me in... That would be undercutting your fundraising.
I want you to keep
fundraising.
Believing that. I want you to keep believing that.
Don't undercut your own fundraising, Bob.
But join me in thanking these wonderful guests. Thank
I
you,
I didn't
guys.
Hear you guys say that at all.
Shane, thank you. Lewis, thank you. Now you go out that way. We do have lunch. It's across the hall. Thanks for coming.